Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Zach Naylor, co-founder and CEO of Aurelius, a fellow podcaster, and we are going to talk about a product strategy today. This episode is brought to you by userlist.io. This new tool helps SaaS founders get a better understanding of each individual user journey and send users relevant behavior-based email. To learn more, join the waiting list at userlist.io. Hey, Zach.
Hey, Jane. How's it going? Thanks for having me.
We are absolutely thrilled to have you as a guest. So before we get started with the main topic, would you like to tell our listeners where you come from and what do you do for a living these days?
Yeah, well, you know, I usually tell people when they ask me what I do is I say I help people make better decisions. And the way that I do that is by learning about what they're trying to do, you know, as a company, as a team, and then learning from their customers, doing research with them. And then trying to find that middle ground and make good decisions that meet both. So I'm definitely a UX designer and product strategy research person by background. And you know, most recently we started our company Aurelius, which is a user research and insights tool for folks just like you and I.
Fantastic. Tell us a bit more about your tool.
Aurelius, sure. Well, you know, Aurelius is really a place where designers, researchers, product teams, even marketers can take all of your, you know, user research and customer feedback notes, get them in one place, tag them, organize them, search them, basically figure out what you learned faster and easier before with that information so that you can create those key insights or those, you know, nuggets, those findings that you want to share with your team to make those better decisions about designs, products, and features.
It's amazing how you built a tool for something that you do for a living as well. So I wonder what came first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, no, that's I think that's a really good question. So the interesting thing there is, as I mentioned, I was doing a lot of this work. At the time, I was actually working at a place called The Nerdery here in Minneapolis, Minnesota in the U.S. for those listening outside the country. And I was doing a lot of this work helping, you know, customers, our clients. So I was basically a consultant, right? And basically I realized that my job was far less about helping people design or build software and app. Because that part's easy, right? It's a lot harder to figure out the right thing to build, the right products, the right features, the right services, the right changes to make. And that key word, the right things to do, really came from a deep understanding of what it is our client or the business was trying to do and a very thorough understanding of the behavior and expectations of their customers. And that was the work that I knew that I was doing, but there wasn't a really good way of articulating that. There wasn't a really good way of, you know, showing the connection between some of those things. And so we decided, hey, I think software can solve this problem and let's give it a go.
Wonderful. I'm glad that both worked out so well for you.
I think so. We're certainly doing our best. Thank you.
So we're going to talk about product strategy today. And it's such a vague thing. And everyone claims, myself included, that they're great at giving advice on product strategy. But it's not that easy. What does product strategy mean for you personally?
That's a great question. And I like defining things before we even discuss them, right? Mm-hmm. Product strategy for me is simply a collection of decisions based on an understanding of what we know from our customers that also help us meet some business goal or objective. That's it at, you know, the highest level. And a little bit more deeply, like, let's talk about, you know, the difference between a strategy and tactic, right? Mm-hmm. So strategy is the what. The tactics or the projects are the how. And I actually recently wrote an article about this on the Aurelius blog, if anybody cares to know. The best teams really aim to figure out what you're doing before you try to figure out how you're doing it. And a good example of that is oftentimes, especially as designers and engineers, you know, we have all of these tools and techniques at our fingertips, and we're, you know, we're kind of itching to act on these things. Oh, should we try this new design technique, or should we try this new piece of technology, et cetera, et cetera. But if we don't know what we're doing and we haven't gotten everybody aligned on exactly what the value we're providing is, then how we go about doing that actually doesn't matter, if that makes sense. And so, you know, oftentimes product teams, they fall into this trap where, you know, they're building new features, they're building maybe even new products and services in some cases, but they haven't really defined what the value that they're trying to provide, both for their business and, more importantly, their customers. And so product strategy then is, you know, bringing a nice understanding between both of those, what we're trying to do and what's important to our customers, to understand what the value is before we ever design or build anything.
You mentioned the word value so many times. What other tactics for defining that value before you get started in the product roadmap?
Yeah, that's a cool question. It's also kind of meta, right? Like, what is the how to get to the what? Okay, so, you know, product strategy really at a high level is their goals for your business, and I break those down into a couple different ways, which I'll talk about. It's some customer insight, something you've learned from actual real people you aim to serve, not guesses, not ideas. And then it's a decision that helps impact positively both of those things. Okay, so let's take a step back. A goal of a product strategy, for me, breaks down into three parts. And for anybody familiar with the idea of OKRs, objectives, key results, it's going to sound very similar because it's almost identical. But so a product strategy goal for me is, you know, number one, it's a goal statement. And this goal statement is quite simply the answer to the question, what are we trying to achieve? Now, that's pretty easy. Let's say our goal is we want to encourage more people to sign up for a free trial. That's fine. Now, part two of the goal is what I often call success indicators. Now, this is actually really, really important, because success indicators are the things we will see, hear, feel, whether or not we're meeting that goal statement. So in this case, it might be things like, you know, we'll see more people coming to our website. We'll see more people going to the free trial page. We'll see more people filling out the form. We will see more people actually completing a free trial. You get the idea. The success indicators are actual behavior that will express whether or not, you know, that goal statement is being met. That behavior is important because, let's face it, most of the people listening to this are people who build products or design products, and behavior is what's important to us. We build things to support or elicit behavior. And so a goal statement's a little bit too vague, but the success indicators give us behavior, something we can all agree on and make better decisions from later. And then part three of that goal is metrics. And that's pretty straightforward. That's the way in which we will measure the success indicators and ultimately the overall goal statement. And those become a lot easier when you know that, well, more people coming to our site, more people actually doing the trial. Well, the metrics there are simple at that point, right? Well, actual sign-up count, number of people in the trial, number of page views maybe, right? The reason I actually start in that order, though, is we often either start only with a goal statement or we go right to metrics. And if you think about the one metric example I used, like more people signing up for the free trial, well, there's probably a half a dozen ways we can actually make that metric move, but we don't know that the right behavior, you know, that the metric was moving because of the right reasons. And so if you actually set up those success indicators to the goal and you have the metrics, then you know, well, we're seeing this behavior and we're seeing the metric move. So all of that should indicate that we're doing a good job, that we're meeting our goals. Make sense?
Fantastic. Thank you for breaking those down. It's surprising how local these and precise all these three components are to the general product life, you know, as in, you know, idea, conception, then building the product, then iterating on that. And that kind of just lightens up a small cycle in the much longer life of a product. A lot of people I know refer to product strategy as to the whole thing, you know, from the birth towards, you know, 5-10 years. And how is that different from being as practical as you are? Because you probably come from, you know, real life background that doesn't work with 10 years. You only work with a small iteration.
Yeah, you know, and that's it's interesting to think about too. The short answer is I believe that planning anything beyond 3 to 6 months is basically just a wild guess. There's because of the world that we live in and the fact that we work with and for human beings that change so dramatically, so quickly, especially now as technology enables us to do so, that planning beyond that, it's just it's an exercise that makes only you feel better. And those plans never really end up the way that you hope they will. I think practical's a pretty good word to put it. I mean, pragmatic might be another one, but basically, you know, the idea here is, and this is why we built Aurelius, frankly, is that you should be learning from your customers all the time. There isn't this, we've done research and we learned a lot and now we're good for 5 or 10 years because, hey, we built this beautiful strategy document off of it. And in fact, you know, that's likely going to change quite a bit, even just by acting on that strategy, right? So even just by starting to build things, parts of your roadmap and your strategy, what you then do is then you elicit new behavior, new expectations and needs from your customers that if you're not learning from, it doesn't matter how well you execute the strategy. Remember, you never had the what defined really well. And that what has to continue to evolve. And that should be based on what you learn from customers. And by the way, what you learn from customers should also then come back and inform, you know, what your goals are for your company and help influence the direction there.
Absolutely. From your experience of working with so many companies and products, what cycle length does make sense between, you know, collecting another round of customer feedback and research?
You know, that's probably going to be pretty specific on the product that you've got and your access to your market. So there are some places where maybe, and I've been in this environment where you're B2B to C, right? So your customers are another business, but then they have clients who are their customers, right? And so then access to the end user as well as access to your customer becomes difficult, but I don't think there's any hard and fast rule. Actually, I'm certain there is no hard and fast rule for how often, you know, you should be doing research with your customers and what that cycle time looks like. I think a better way of thinking about it would be to say, be very clear with ourselves. Again, set up goals in the way, you know, whether the way I recommend or something else, but be thorough. And whenever you find yourself at a point where you don't have as much confidence or information to make a decision about designs, features, product changes, then you know it's time that you should be learning from customers, right?
Mm-hmm. That's a great strategy. I agree. Totally depends on the business itself. Well, let's jump to actually documenting your strategy and how you go around. You structured it very well in goals and success indicators and metrics. So what you can do, just open up a Google Doc and write those down as an MVP of your product strategy for the next iteration.
Yeah, I mean, I think that works just fine, to be completely honest. I mean, so like I said, a product strategy in its basic form are smart, informed decisions that help you meet something you've learned from your customers as well as the goals that you set forward. And so, yeah, if you do nothing other than simply say, I recommend we, you know, change this design or add this new feature. The reason I recommend that is because here's what we learned from customers. This leads us to believe it'll solve that problem. And by the way, we think making this decision will help us meet this business goal we have. It seems like such a simple thing, and you know, you and I are having a conversation about this, but people still are not working this way regularly. A lot of the times, you know, design updates, product changes, new features and services, they come from just ideas. And the fact of the matter is, ideas are not in someone's head. An idea is an expression of something they learned and saw in their worldview and their experience, right? Now that all of that stuff comes from an exposure to living in this world. Now, if you just simply focus that and say, well, I want to get exposed to the people we're here to serve, then those ideas get better because they're more aligned with the people you're making something for. And trust me when I tell you, while we built Aurelius to solve absolutely our own problem, we are not our customers. And I still regularly do research and try to understand the needs of those people because it surprises me every day. I think I live the problem. We use Aurelius ourselves. And yet, you know, the things that you learn from people you build things for, even as quickly as a few weeks after you maybe release something or before you release something. You'd be surprised on, you know, what kind of perspective that can bring to your work.
When we talk about early product stages, when you are working on a very rough MVP, and myself personally, we're currently at that stage at userlist.io, and that can be quite embarrassing when you have nothing to put out yet, or you have something that really does not stand up to your own standards. However, everybody screams that you should be collecting feedback as early as possible. So when is that appropriate time to start letting users in into your embarrassing MVP version and collecting those insights?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the thing is, you know, embarrassment is, I don't know. I don't think people should be embarrassed about doing anything. You know, it goes back to this one quote from, you know, Theodore Roosevelt. So again, U.S. president in the past. For those of you listening outside the U.S., but it's about the man in the arena, and he says that there's a lot of people who will criticize the man in the arena, but the man in the arena is the one actually putting the work forward, actually taking action. And it's very easy to criticize someone when you have no other solution, and it's just, you know, you're kind of an armchair quarterback. But so much for that. I mean, answering your question, I don't think anybody should be embarrassed by doing that. And the best way to get that feedback is quite simply to ask. And I would argue that while you might not have, maybe not you specifically, Jane, but while you might not have a product to show, what you do have is an idea, a problem that you believe can be solved. And especially in the world we live in today, if you're working in, you know, software or digital services in some way, it's very easy to put up a website and simply say, here's the problem I think needs solved. Here's the way we believe we should solve it. If that's you and you have that kind of problem, you should sign up for our list and tell us about that. And that even in and of itself, right, what that does is it gives you an idea. If there are enough people who have the same problem that you believe needs solved, and whether or not you should pursue that. Now, the numbers don't always tell you everything, right? But there's a very big difference between somebody saying, well, I don't know why I would ever need that, and all of a sudden 300 people signing up for that list. Oh, wow, well, that's interesting. 300 people believe that problem should be solved. Now, whether or not you have the right solution yet, which, by the way, you won't in those early stages, doesn't actually matter. It knows that you should pursue it, right? And then guess what you have? You have 300 people who want to tell you exactly how you should go about solving that problem and start helping you form those ideas. And guess what? That's definitely user research. That's customer research before you even have a product.
I've been there, and I've been to the situations where it does not exactly prove things. So with some experience, we've learned that nothing but actually payments made are great validation, and actually payments made are not always a validation that people will be using your product, which I was so surprised to learn. Do you have any interesting validation stories from your own experience?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a huge... So I think everything there in figuring out whether or not this is a problem worth solving, yes, a bunch of people signing up and saying, yeah, I think that that's worth solving is a good first step. I could not agree more with what you just said. And, you know, the rubber meets the road when somebody says, I'm willing to pay you to solve this problem. So let's say 300 of those people signed up and said, yeah, I think you should definitely solve this problem. I mean, that's a great idea. You know, maybe 50 of them will actually pay you to do it. Well, that's okay. The sooner you can get to those 50, then all of a sudden you start to really refine what that solution is, right? And it's interesting because on our podcast, we actually had a guy by the name of Patrick Campbell. He's the CEO of Price Intelligently.
Oh, yeah.
He does a lot of user research. Yeah, but he does it specifically around pricing. And so he talks about some of that stuff on the episode that we had. But the long and short of it is, yep, there's a lot of people who believe something should exist in the world. But they're not willing to part with their time, money, or resources for that, right? And so while it might still be a problem worth solving, it may not be a business. And so there's clearly a difference there, right? And then you got to, figuring out where the business lies is you got to really figure out, A, this problem for the people who are willing to pay for it, is that sustainable, and are there enough of them to create a viable business depending on your model, right? And I couldn't possibly answer that for anybody. There's so many different ways to build a business, in my opinion. It certainly is not just, you know, the venture-backed deal, which we are not. We are 100% bootstrapped here at Aurelius, by the way. So it's very different even for us. But, you know, some of what you're asking, I think, Jane, is really like product validation and like getting to that product market fit as a business. User research definitely helps there. But, you know, you need to think about the market that you have, whether it's big enough, if you can access them. And there's research you can do to get to that. But that's a little bit outside of the scope of, well, it's definitely outside the scope of product strategy, because you can have the best product strategy in the world. And you can have the best product in the world, but if there's not enough people to make it a business, then it kind of won't matter.
Yeah, that leads us to marketing and other different topics.
Definitely.
So I imagine software businesses being at one of those stages. So one is being, you know, conceived, as we discussed, from scratch and building an MVP and getting it out. Another is prospering and setting up short-term goals according to your system and working through those. And the most painful state is when you launched and have been out there for a while but have not achieved that mysterious product market fit. That is, your business is not prospering. What is your advice on putting together product strategy then for those hard situations?
You know, I don't even think that that's necessarily a product strategy problem at that point. Mm-hmm. Because product market fit and product strategy don't always coincide for me.
Oh, that's a great insight. That's a surprise.
Yeah, I know. It probably is surprising, especially hearing that from me. And let me clarify what I mean on that too. Because product market fit is saying, the problem that you have, the problem that you're solving, the solution you're providing also matches a market, a group of people who also have that problem and want it solved that way, right? So your product strategy can be based on that, but if you don't have the right audience for the solution you're providing, your company, your product, then your product strategy doesn't matter. Does that make sense? So that's why I say they don't always coincide for me. One, I think, precludes the other. So I think you need to figure out if you have product market fit first, mm-hmm. and then to build a product strategy from that. So, I mean, even just taking a step back, like, you'll know, right? you'll know if you have product market fit, because what's going to happen is people are either going to be talking about you and telling their friends and other, you know, professional colleagues, if you're in that kind of world, about what you're doing, and people will be coming to you despite any effort you're putting forward, or they won't. To me, that was like one of the very first indicators for us. Some of the early things we were building at Aurelius, a lot of people thought was really interesting, right? We had people, just the same scenario we talked about, Jane, we had people sign up, yeah, this was awesome, mm-hmm. I'm really curious about this. And then, you know, will you buy it? Will you pay for it? Well, no. And then we didn't find anybody necessarily coming and finding us, right? Then we made some changes in what we... So, I mean, I will actually even say version one of Aurelius was very much a product strategy tool. And, you know, we purposely launched version two back in February, very solely focused on user research and insights. Because what we learned is that that was the biggest problem people had in their product strategy. Right. Mm-hmm. Most people weren't necessarily like in a mature enough team to be working in a way that a product strategy tool like that helped. But what they were trying to solve is a better way to get everything they learned from their customer, just as we said, like tagged, organized, searched, and able to create key insights to make better decisions from. So what we did is we said, well, we're going to do that. We're going to take that piece, you know, inject it with steroids and make it the best app that that can be. Because what will happen is we'll solve the first immediate problems people have today that they are willing to pay for. And then what's naturally going to happen, and we're already starting to see this in our product strategy, is that some of the prior features we had in Aurelius are now coming up as requests from customers today. Now, how interesting is that, right? We built this. This was launched a year and a half ago, Jane. Mm-hmm. But what happened was, again, just as I mentioned, your product strategy needs to evolve even based on what you then launch and solve for people. Because now what's happened is we're helping them solve, you know, this central research repository and this insights tool. And now that that's solved for them, what it's done is created not new problems, but it's created an awareness of other problems or other opportunities for them. Oh, wow, well, I should be able to take this research and do this with it. Or, you know, it would be great if this thing also happened. Yep, we've thought of that. We just decided to step back, focus on a single problem, do that really well, and then allow behavior and expectations to help lead us where our product goes next.
So did you actually kill some of those initial features, or did you rebuild the product from scratch?
Entirely.
Oh, wow. That's a lot.
We killed the whole thing. So we had paying customers on version one, and we actually completely stopped taking new customers. It was a pretty bold move on our part. We completely stopped taking paying customers on version one, and while we built version two. Now, the original goal was that we were going to take the research and insights piece of version one, build its own app, and integrate them. Well, what happened is, and this is how we knew we had product market fit, is we launched version two into beta. So it was for free. And this was the research and insights tool. So what you see is in Aurelius today. What happened, Jane, was very quickly our beta eclipsed everything, like all the use of version one. In fact, even our paying customers of version one told us that they were exclusively using version two in beta.
Uh-huh.
So that was a clear enough indication for us. Well, this is obviously the prize horse, you know, right, for lack of a better term. And so we made, at that point, it was no longer actually even a hard decision. We said, well, you know what? We're going to shut down version one entirely. We're no longer going to support it. We'll eventually sunset the product altogether. And we publicly launched version two and have way more paying customers even on that, is early as we are in the cycle here. And Since February.
Well, I'm so glad for you as a founder, because not all founders are that lucky to have such textbook example of an iteration of a fail that was little enough to lead you to an insight and build something else, because usually it ends at the previous point.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I would personally not consider it textbook. And anybody who knows me is going to appreciate this point. I don't necessarily believe in luck in that case, right? So there's for any of you rap fans out there, there's a Rick Ross song, and in one of them it goes, I believe in the hustle. I don't F with luck. And I actually very much live by that, because I think hard work and listening and paying attention is what leads you to these insights. And so trust me when I tell you, it's very easy for me to say this on a podcast. It was an incredible amount of work for us to figure this out. And it was an incredible amount of work to redesign and redevelop our product, literally three times, being just two people and 100% bootstrapped. It's something I'm very proud of, but all it takes is simply slowing down, listening to your customers, your prospective customers, and making good decisions based on how you can meet their needs.
That's one simple sentence that translates to so much work, as you said.
Mm-hmm. Simple and easy are mutually exclusive.
Right. I have a question. So product strategy at the top level translate to what we talked about. How does that transfer to the actual to-do lists of people you have on your team, be it a small team or a large team, and you've been at both?
Yeah, definitely. So let's consider the product strategy at the top level. I'll even use Aurelius as an example, right? As we said, the first thing you got to be able to do is take really good notes and research feedback in Aurelius. That's just like, that's baseline stuff. We know that if you can't do that, all the other things we would build wouldn't matter. So that's where we started, right? And then there was these other things where you should then be able to create key insights from them. You should be able to tag them and view those things. So, right? So your product strategy, even your roadmap, basically just as I've just described it, right, is there's your 3 to 6 month roadmap right there. How that would then translate into teams is you say, well, here's the thing we're working on. This is the value we're trying to provide. It's defined. Here's why it's good for us. Here's why it's good for our customers. And more importantly, here's what's coming next. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so then how that translates into teams is you can say, we're very confident that this is the thing we're building. Now we have the opportunity to focus on executing at the most precise, high-quality level that we can. And this goes back to that article that I wrote in defining what before the how. If you don't have a really well-defined what, a really well-defined, you know, decision for your product strategy, what you'll find is as you start working on the projects, you're arguing about what you're doing as well as how you're doing it. And then things just become a mess, right? And I'm sure everybody's been part of a project like that where, you know, all of a sudden you're arguing about the specific details of how you're doing a design or a feature. But then you're kind of zooming out a little bit and going, well, should we even be doing this to begin with? That's really bad, right? That's a bad sign. And so a solid product strategy at the top level gives you confidence that you're working on the right things. And so then practically for us as designers, we know, yep, we have confidence, we have insights from our customer, and we know it's good for the business on what we're doing. Now we can do things like refine what we're working on. We can make very rapid prototypes and test them quickly to get to the little, you know, the specific individual pieces and break down that work to make every little bit as refined and high quality as we can.
That's a great ideal process. But what do you do with the constant flow of feedback and new insights and new demands that keep coming up all the time during those 3 to 6 months that you mentioned?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, I think the easiest answer probably is twofold for me. In one hand, be open to it. Mm-hmm. Be open to hearing that feedback and be open to change. Like I said, planning beyond 3 to 6 months is essentially a waste of time because of exactly the point you just brought up, Jane, is, you know, you're going to release something and people are going to go, whoa, this is a huge deal for me. And now this thing needs to happen. And guess what? Your beautiful 18-month plan just went down the drain because there's now all of a sudden more important needs to be met, right? So on one hand, be open to that. On the other hand, be really good. And again, this comes from a solid set of goals for your product and experience, but be really firm and be confident to say no. There are things that you shouldn't do. There are things, I know that this probably sounds like sacrilege coming from a UX guy, but there are things you shouldn't do for your customers, because a lot of times, you know, when people will give only feedback, this is why there's a difference between user research and feedback, by the way. But sometimes when people just give feedback and react to something, they're not actually helping you understand their needs. They're not actually understanding, you know, you're not understanding their behavior or why that's important to them. It's just a reaction. And so what you can do, you know, if people just said, oh, I really don't like the way we take notes. This didn't happen, but as an example, we could have went and just redesigned the notes piece. But the better thing to do there is understand why they don't like notes. Well, it's because, you know, I don't feel like typing them all out. Whoa, all of a sudden, the problem isn't with the note-taking mechanism, right? The problem is with the amount of time it takes to type them out manually. So perhaps there's a different solution there. You get where I'm going with this? So it really is, you know, at the first point, I guess just to summarize again, is be open to changing that. Be open to hearing it and saying, wow, this, we have this new set of meaning. We have a new understanding that we should put into our product strategy. And then the other part of that is having the confidence to be able to say no. A really great strategy is saying no to all the things you shouldn't do more than it is saying yes to the things that you should.
I think I just came across an article, a famous article from Basecamp, about saying no confidently to your customers and not making them wait and not giving promises for the next, you know, 2 years that, about the features that you might build.
Yeah, totally. Well, it wouldn't surprise me if somewhere deep in my psyche, that's where that really came from, because I'm huge fans of those guys at Basecamp, both, you know, who I think they are on a personal level and the company they've built and the philosophy they have. I frankly speaking wish more companies held that perspective and we're just willing to slow down and say no to things and just do, you know, a few things exceptionally well, like blindingly well than anybody else.
Yeah, that's a wonderful, wonderful takeaway. Unfortunately, we have to wrap up today's episode. I would love to hear your take on what people can read, where people can go to learn more about product strategy and probably about research and getting appropriate user feedback, maybe your own resources or something you admire personally.
Sure. Well, there's a couple things I'd share. So we have, as you mentioned at the beginning of our chat, Jane, we run our own podcast here at Aurelius where we, you know, I interview people who are very, very smart and have a lot to share with regard to product strategy and user research. You can find that right on our website. I certainly do write some articles as well, and hopefully those are useful for people. But one person I would definitely look into is a woman by the name of Christina Woodke. So we actually had her on the podcast. She talks a lot about product strategy and has actually written a book on OKRs. She's a fantastic resource. Another one is Erica Hall. She talks a lot about user research, and I think that she is very, it is my opinion, she's very practical about what user research is and what problems it can solve, as well as Indy Young. Again, these are all actually guests we had on our podcast, so I would invite you to listen to those and definitely read what these folks have to say about research and product strategy. But one book I would recommend to people that is probably an unlikely source is How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie.
Interesting.
So you're laughing, and I have to believe that probably caught you by surprise. But here's the reason why is, you know, most of us, Jane, are not entrepreneurs or people who are starting their own companies and products. A lot of us work with a team. A lot of us work for a company that has stakeholders. And guess what? Those are people. And we have very strong opinions as designers and engineers and product people about what we should make. And we talk a lot about building empathy for the people that we're trying to serve, but we don't often spend nearly enough time figuring out and learning about the people we work with and for. And if we're going to sell our ideas really well, and if we're going to help convince people that these are the right things to do on behalf of our customers, we have to know how it meets the needs of the business. That's just as important to building great products and selling your ideas and building the things that really matter to the people you serve.
That was one of my favorite books in high school, literally. Awesome. But not for software development, for sure.
Yeah, of course. I've been given a talk recently that it talks a lot about that, building empathy for your stakeholders and how to sell your ideas, because, you know, I don't think people, it's just far too overlooked where the people we work with are humans as well. And we often just want to dismiss it if they don't, you know, quote unquote, get it. Oh, well, they're not a designer or they're not an engineer. They don't get it. They don't get why this is good for the customer. It's our job to help them see why this is good for the customer, how it's good for the business. And we can't do that unless we learn from them just as much as we learn from our customers.
Absolutely. And what matters in communication is what people understand ultimately, what they get, not what you want to convey with your words. And especially amazing if they pay for it.
That's great. Yeah, everybody wins.
All right. Where can people find you online if that's different from the Aurelius resources that you shared?
Yeah, well, I'm pretty easy to find there. I try to pay a pretty good amount of attention on Twitter, and you can just find me. I'm Zach Naylor on Twitter, which is ZackNaylor. Happy to chat with people on there. And then, you know, we have the on-site chat at Aurelius. I do my best to answer every single one of those personally, and I mean that. So, yeah, I'm pretty easy to find.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for sharing your insights today. It was great to have such an extensive conversation on such an abstract subject, and I really enjoyed it.
Well, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I had fun as well, and hopefully people get some value out of it, because value is important.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, and have a great day, Zach.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.